This program is sponsored by the United States Naval Institute. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents for a discussion by author Bill Trimble on his book entitled Admiral John S. McCain and the Triumph of Naval Air Power. I'm your host, Rob Havers, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago and is sponsored by the United States Naval Institute. This program and hundreds more covering a full range of military topics is available on demand at pritzkermilitary.org. Spanning most of the first half of the 20th century, Admiral John Sidney McCain Sr.'s life and career highlights the integration of aviation into the Navy. This evolution emphasized the development of the aircraft carrier from a tactical element of the fleet, stressing sea control, to a strategic force capable of long-range power projection. Although much of the book focuses on carrier aviation, McCain Sr. was instrumental in the emergence of flying boats. These were considered essential for long-range reconnaissance in the Pacific. McCain understood the power and potential of carrier-based aviation, initially as commanding officer of the USS Ranger before the war, and then as a carrier task force commander under Admiral William F. Halsey in the Pacific in World War II. Admiral McCain Sr. started a long-standing military service tradition within the McCain family. Admiral McCain's son, John S. McCain Jr. was a submarine commander in World War II and later served as Commander-in-Chief Pacific Command during the Vietnam War. His grandson, John S. McCain III, was a U.S. Navy pilot during the Vietnam War and was shot down and spent over 5 years as a POW in the infamous Hanoi Hilton and other North Vietnamese camps. Bill Trimble is Professor Emeritus at Auburn University in Alabama. His most recent book is Hero of the Air, Glenn Curtiss and the Birth of Naval Aviation. He is also the author of Wings for the Navy, A History of the Naval Aircraft Factory, Admiral William A. Moffett, Architect of Naval Aviation, among other books and articles. Please join me in welcoming William Trimble to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
Thank you very much, Rob. I'm delighted to be here and thank all the Pritzker people. Especially want to thank my wife, Sharon, because she really helped out a lot as far as this book was concerned. She spent a lot of time with me at the National Archives up on the fifth floor scanning photographs for this book. She also sweated over she doesn't sweat very much, though, I don't think. She also labored over a photocopy machine at the Hoover Institution, which has McCain papers there, so I want to thank her for all of her time and effort over these years of many books, and I really appreciate it. I'm delighted to be here. I'm going to talk about John S. McCain and the triumph of naval air power, and basically what I want to do is to use McCain as a vehicle, and this is what I try to do with all my biographies, use these individuals, these people, as vehicles for telling a bigger story, in this case about the development of naval aviation. This was not something that I originated. It was not really my idea to do this. Actually, very few of my books have been my ideas. There's always somebody else who says, hey, you need to do this. And like a fool, I'll say, oh, that sounds great. And then 9 years later, I have a book. So let me back up a little bit here and explain why I'm doing this. First of all, a good friend of mine at Texas A&M University named Jim Bradford said that after I finished my Curtiss book, he said, you know, you need something to do, especially if you're moving into retirement. And I said, oh, sure, Jim, what do you suggest? He said, how about a book on John S. McCain? And immediately I think, John S. McCain, the Arizona senator. And he said, no, his grandfather, who was a carrier task force commander in World War II. And I said, hey, that's not a bad idea at all. I have name recognition right away. And the other thing about it was I had just finished working on very early naval aviation with Glenn Curtis, and I thought it might be neat to be able to bookend that with somebody who came late to naval aviation. And in fact, somebody who was excoriated by some of the naval aviation pioneers as being a Johnny come lately. And I thought, well, let's just see what this means about this Johnny come lately and what they meant for naval aviation, since I'd done some of the very early stuff to begin with. So that was the origins of this. Again, not so much my idea as much as it was Jim Bradford's. Then I began to look into this and see, well, what does this really mean? It's not enough simply to go ahead and tell the McCain story, even though that in and of itself is worthwhile. What was happening here as far as naval aviation was concerned? How was it changing over the period of time that John McCain was involved with it? And one of the things that I came up with, and how original it is, I'm not really sure, was that before World War II, the aircraft carrier in particular was simply an adjunct to the fleet, an adjunct to the battle fleet, involved with tactical operations with the battle fleet and supplementing the battle fleet, mostly in terms of protecting the battle fleet from attacking aircraft and also doing long-range scouting and so forth. And then as the war progressed, and basically at the beginning of the war, that's what it was doing, but then as the war progressed, and especially by the time you get to 1945, the aircraft carrier and especially the carrier task force as an integrated unit was functioning in a completely different level, a much higher level than it had been before, at a strategic level. And I'll deal with that a little bit later in the talk when the operations off Japan, and I hope you'll see what's going on there. So completely changing, transforming what the aircraft carrier meant as far as the technology is concerned. And that transition from sea control to power projection I tried to hit on as much as possible. I also went into this with a lot of trepidation, because there is a lot of stuff that's written about the Pacific War. There's a lot of stuff that's been written about the Navy in the Pacific War. And I thought, well, what can I contribute to that? And the more I looked at that as well, led me to what I call the Midway Morrison Syndrome. That is, that a lot of people think that all you have to know about World War II in the Pacific and the Navy in the Pacific is what's been written about the Battle of Midway in June of 1942. And I don't know how many books, they're probably all out here in the library, have been written on Midway. The other thing was, why would you do anything about this? Because you have Samuel Eliot Morrison's History of United States Naval Operations in World War II that tells you everything you need to know about the Pacific War. And the more I dug into it, the more I realized, hey, guess what, folks? There is way more than Midway, and there's way more than Morrison, even though both of them are, of course, very important to the Pacific War. Another aspect of it was that a very good historian named Clark Reynolds, and some of you may be familiar with him and his work, published a book, jeepers, when was it? 1968, called The Fast Carriers, where he really dug into what these carriers were involved with, what carrier warfare was involved with in the Pacific especially. An incredible amount of work that he put into it, and a really very good writer. And I thought, that's fine, you know, here you have that. The interesting thing about Reynolds' book on the fast carriers and also his biography of John Towers is that they are very critical of John S. McCain, Sr. And I thought, well, okay, there's something there. Maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. Maybe there's a way to correct some of this. Maybe there's some way to bring more balance to this. Not that McCain didn't make any mistakes and legitimately made mistakes, but at least something to bring some balance to what has been written before. And then finally, I have been very interested in doing biography. I think I've done what now? Maybe Sharon needs to help me out. Three biographies. And I've always liked biographies because they provide a personal view of history that you don't normally get otherwise. To me, it brings more history to life than you would have otherwise. And also involved with this is that you have an opportunity to use that person's life to be able to tell a bigger story. So that intrigued me as well. Let's see what we can do with John S. McCain and see what it means as far as naval warfare in the Pacific was concerned, and before that as well. John McCain was born in a small town on the edges of the Delta in Mississippi. in August of 1884. Interestingly, he did not go immediately to the Naval Academy. He spent a year at the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, in Oxford, Mississippi, and then transferred as a sophomore to the Naval Academy and graduated in the class of 1906. He actually graduated early in the class of 1906 because they desperately needed officers at that time as the Navy was expanding. And you'll see up here his nickname, SLU. Well, coming out of the Naval Academy, midshipmen, past midshipmen as they were then known, had all kinds of nicknames. They acquired all sorts of nicknames. And the one that stuck with McCain was SLU. And I have no idea how he got that nickname. Possibly because some of these areas in the Delta tributaries leading into the Mississippi were called sloughs. Possibly because people thought he walked funny and had a slew-footed gait. No one really knows. No one can be sure about how he gained that nickname. He was not known by his family as SLU. He was always John Sidney. So in my biography, I tended to use John Sidney more than I use SLU. He had a varied career. The idea in the Navy, as maybe some of you know, is that you want to get as broad experience as possible and to have as much experience in various commands, both ashore and at sea. And McCain in particular spent a lot of time in his early career on shore, especially in the Bureau of Navigation in Washington. And you say, what the Bureau of Navigation, what does that mean? You think it means how you develop maps and charts and navigation instruments, and that's part of it. But the big part of what was involved in the Bureau of Navigation, and this is what really runs the Navy, is that it was responsible for personnel. And he became an expert in personnel issues during the three tours that he had at the Bureau of Navigation in Washington. And I have the dates up there simply because I can't remember what they were. But you'll see three tours he had here in the 1920s and into the part of the 1930s. And there he became the expert on personnel. He went up to Capitol Hill all the time to talk with Congress in various hearings dealing with naval personnel. And especially what he wanted to do here was to ensure that there was a good balance between the seniority that was so important in the Navy and the various merits that you have as a result of your active duty. And also to balance how staff officers, especially those in the construction corps, would be promoted at the same rate as line officers would be. So he's dealing with these really complex personnel issues during the 1920s and 1930s, and he was really much he was the go-to guy as far as Congress was concerned when they were dealing with personnel issues. Another thing about being posted to Washington was that he got to know politics in Washington. He got to know the key people in Congress. He got to know the key people as far as the Navy was concerned, high up in the naval naval hierarchy. Especially here, he worked in the Bureau of Navigation under Admiral William Leahy, and that name may be familiar to you. In World War II, William Leahy was Franklin Roosevelt's representative on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So here was a high-up person who befriended McCain and really helped him as far as his career was concerned. You can't go very far in the Navy unless you serve time on a battleship, and ideally you would like to have a battleship command. Well, McCain did not have a battleship command, but he did serve as the executive officer on the New Mexico in 1926. And for those of you who know the Navy and know how the Navy runs, it's the exec on a ship who makes things happen. That's the person who really makes sure the day-to-day operations of the ship are being carried out. And it was a battleship, so that was important for him as well. His first command, and this is kind of strange if you're looking at a career, his first command was on the USS Nitro. The Nitro was an ammunition ship. What it had to do was to go around the fleet, literally going from base to base and ship to ship, wherever the fleet might be, delivering ammunition, especially to the battle fleet. And that was a good experience for him. It was a smaller ship. It allowed him to exercise some of his command authority in a smaller environment, a more intimate environment than maybe a battleship would have been. And he was all over the place. I lost track of how many times he transited the Panama Canal in the Nitro. And he was there from 1931 to 1933. And I put those dates up there because I can't remember dates. He had friends in Washington, as I mentioned before. And that was going to help him as far as his interest in aviation was concerned and ultimately his involvement in aviation. I mentioned Bill Leahy before. The chief of naval operations, or actually I should say before that, the chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics, and then later on the chief of naval operations, Ernest King, became a friend and was very helpful to McCain throughout throughout his career. Carl Vinson was the chair of the House Naval Affairs Committee. He was friends with McCain as well as a result of many of the personnel hearings that were held at that time. So he had friends in high places, which helped a lot. And then in 1935 and 1936, he went to Pensacola for aviation training. He said that he was always interested in aeronautics and aviation, and I wonder if that's really true. I think in a way he looked at his career at that point in the 1930s and decided that this might be a better avenue for higher command than simply staying in the battleship Navy. That maybe here's an opportunity, if I learn to fly, that I'll be able to get a carrier command. And that it's not a battleship, but it's maybe the second largest ship that you're going to have in the Navy, and that might be just as good as far as my career is concerned. So he went to Pensacola. He earned his wings at Pensacola at the age of 51. Imagine that, learning to fly at the age of 51. Only William Halsey, only Bill Halsey, was older than him as an aviator, and only by a matter of months in their early 50s. He was not the world's greatest flyer. But he was adequate enough to earn his wings and then gain his entry into aviation. Now, first of all, what he was involved with were patrol squadrons. And when I talk about patrol squadrons, I really mean these long-range flying boats. And Rob mentioned in the introduction how important long-range flying boats were for the Navy. They provided the eyes for the fleet. They had the range to be able to advance in front of the fleet, identify where particular adversaries may be, report back to the fleet, and provide that scouting operations, which were so important to the Navy at that point. His first assignment was to the Naval Air Station at Coco Solo in the Canal Zone. And there he was responsible for a lot of these patrol operations that went out into the Caribbean, especially in relation to some of the operations that the Atlantic Fleet was carrying out there. And that was between 1936 and 1937. And then he went to San Diego, to North Island, between 1939 and then the beginning of the war in 1942. Again, responsible for the patrol squadrons operating out of North Island and out of San Diego. And not just for those in that area, but also for all of those patrol squadrons that were operating in the Pacific, including those operating out of Hawaii. So he had broad administrative responsibilities there that stood him in good stead. I also want to say something about the seniority problem in the Navy and naval aviation. And this relates to the Johnny-come-lately aspects of his career. One of the problems that the pioneer aviators had was that they were junior officers. They didn't have the seniority to be able to carry out as captains, major commands, major ship commands. They simply were not advanced enough as captains to be able to have a battleship commander or even a carrier command. And some of these pioneer aviators, John Towers in particular, who was naval aviator number three, was adamant about how important it was that these people get into these command positions and be advanced maybe beyond people who were surface officers into those command positions. So that was really what was going on. Towers in particular, but other pioneer aviators, really resented what was going on here as far as advancing some of these people like Halsey, advancing some of these people like McCain into senior aviation commands just after they came out of Pensacola. But the problem was that the Navy needed these aviators. They needed senior aviators to be able to take these kinds of commands, and they couldn't wait for people like Towers and more junior officers to advance into those positions. So this was something that undergirded much of what was going on as far as McCain's career was concerned and what was going on in naval aviation. He did gain carrier command. He was hoping that he would have a larger carrier, a more impressive carrier, something like the Saratoga or the Lexington. Those would be carrier commands that you would really like to have. And he was disappointed in a way when he got command of the Ranger. The Ranger was the Navy's first carrier that was designed and built as a carrier from the keel up. The Lexington and Saratoga were battle cruiser conversions. And he had the command of the Ranger between 1937 and 1939, actually just before he went out to North Island. What he did here with the Ranger was really pretty remarkable. He participated in exercises in the Pacific with other carriers, with the battleship fleet. These exercises were referred to as fleet problems. Came back and participated in fleet problems in the Caribbean. The Ranger was all over the place. Also, especially with some of these operations and some of these exercises in the Caribbean, he was working with other aircraft carriers as well. The Saratoga and Lexington, for example, were involved with this. So you start to see here the emergence of multi-carrier operations where carriers have to work together in order to carry out those operations. Now, it's nothing like what happened by the end of the Pacific War, but at least gave him a sense of what was going on as far as working with multiple carriers were concerned. The real key to his history, the real key to his position as far as naval aviation was concerned, took place in early 1942 when he gained command of all aircraft forces in the South Pacific. And I want to back up a little bit on that and talk about the strategic dilemma that the Navy faced, that the United States faced, as far as the Pacific War was concerned, into 1942. First of all, remember that there was a war going on in Europe, and there were only so many resources that were going to be available. And the decision was made at the very highest levels, as far as the command authority was concerned, that the principal resources, 80%, would go to Europe. So what was going to happen in the Pacific? The Pacific was only going to be able to take whatever that 20% of those resources that were left over. The problem with that is the Pacific was the Navy's war. The Navy was planning for a Pacific war since the teens. And here was an opportunity, obviously, to fight that war, but they were only going to be able to fight that with limited resources. So they had to understand that as far as the strategy was concerned. King understood that. Ernest King, as Chief of the Naval Operations, saw that big picture and saw what was needed in Europe, in the European theater, and saw what was needed in the Pacific. Now, in the Pacific, King had a very clear idea about what the problems were, what the threats were to the South Pacific in particular. And his concern was about the lines of communication coming from the west coast of the United States to Australia and New Zealand. And he felt it was absolutely essential that you keep those lines of communication open through the South Pacific. Well, what all the Navy planning had been, again, since the teens, had been the Central Pacific, operating in stages through the Central Pacific until you got to the Philippines and you fought a decisive battle with the Japanese in the Philippines and then ultimately won the war. So there was that tension. King, as Chief of Naval Operations, seeing the South Pacific as being more important. You also have the command under Chester Nimitz in Hawaii thinking more about the Central Pacific, and I don't want my resources, limited as they are, to go to the South Pacific. So that was the strategic dilemma. And ultimately, King won out. He said, you're going to put your emphasis here on the South Pacific as much as possible. So McCain became the commander aircraft South Pacific, or Comm Air SOPAC, and again, I put these dates up here because I wouldn't remember them otherwise, on May 1st of 1942. As Comm Air SOPAC, he was responsible for all tender-based and land-based aircraft operating in the entire theater of the South Pacific. And that involved Navy, Marine, that involved Army aircraft as well. New Zealanders were involved with this as well. So he's very much a complicated command that he was responsible for. And as such, what he had to do, his principal responsibility, was to carry out searches. Searches reporting on where the Japanese fleet might be, how they might be operating in the South Pacific at that time. And it all came together with the invasion of Guadalcanal in August of 1942. McCain was responsible for all the land and tender-based, and when I say tender-based, I mean seaplane tenders operating flying boats in the South Pacific, especially supporting the Guadalcanal landings. He was crucial to what was going on here. The landings took place on August 8th, and on the night of August 8th and 9th of 1942, a Japanese cruiser division came into the landing area. This was a night operation. The Japanese were very good at night operations. Shellfire, torpedo, sank four Allied cruisers in the Battle of Savo Island. It was one of the worst defeats that the United States Navy has ever encountered. And fortunately, the Japanese withdrew before they could get in and among the landing forces actually there off the beaches at Guadalcanal. One of the problems that happened here and one of the controversies that emerged was that McCain's scouting forces did not find that cruiser division, did not find and report that Japanese cruiser division. And many people, especially Richmond Kelly Turner, who was responsible for the amphibious operation itself, criticized McCain endlessly for not spotting and not reporting on that Japanese cruiser force. Now, you got to understand how complex the command situation was. You didn't have instantaneous communications. The Japanese cruiser force actually came in from an area that was covered by the Southwest Pacific, which was not a Navy command. That was MacArthur's command. So it really was out of the area where McCain's forces were scouting. Nevertheless, he was criticized for that by a number of people high up in the Navy command at that point. His forces were also involved, McCain's forces were also involved in the Battle of the Eastern Solomons. This was a carrier battle in which the Japanese mobile fleet encountered Frank Jack Fletcher's small task force off Guadalcanal in the Eastern Solomon Islands. Now here, McCain's forces did spot some of the Japanese. They didn't spot the main Japanese carrier force, but they did spot the invasion force, which was covered by a smaller Japanese aircraft carrier, and reported it in time to Frank Jack Fletcher, the carrier commander, who was able to launch a strike against that small carrier and ultimately sink it. So in the Battle of Eastern Solomons, if he was being criticized for deficiencies at the Battle of Savo Island, he was now carrying out his responsibilities very well in the Battle of the Eastern Solomons. And I usually don't put maps up here, but this gives you an idea, I hope, about some of the complexity of the search operations that McCain had to carry out. Especially here, coordinating these operations that went out usually in the late afternoon, sometimes carrying out 10 hours of flight operations before returning, coordinating the various sectors that were involved with this, bringing some of the seaplane tenders forward basing them as much as possible to be able to carry out these operations. Gives you an idea of the complexity of this at that stage of the war. You can see his command airplane. This was a consolidated Catalina amphibian. And what McCain liked to do was to get out there among his people and be able to communicate with them as much as possible. He flew on combat missions that some of these PBYs flew on. And he was very much respected by the Marines because he was there at Guadalcanal after the carriers left. He didn't haul ass, as some of the Marines say, and he stayed around at Guadalcanal during this period of when it was in the balance. There's no question about that. You can see one of his advanced bases on the island of Espiritu Santo as McCain moved these forces forward as much as possible in the Solomon Islands. A very complex, and one of the things I ran into, I keep saying complex, one of the things I ran into with this biography was how complex these stories are. And one of the complexities of this was the command situation and the command shakeup that took place in September and October of 1942. Chester Nimitz, who was Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet in Hawaii, was not happy with what happened at Savo Island. No one was really happy with what happened at Savo Island. And he felt that McCain did deserve some of the blame for not being able to spot and report on the Japanese cruiser force that came in. So he was not high up on Nimitz's list of people who were favored, let me put it that way. What also was going on was something in Washington. Admiral King was not a friend of the then chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics, John Towers. He wanted Towers out of Washington. Towers then was assigned to the command of all aircraft in the Pacific under Nimitz. So he moved from Washington as chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics, moved from Washington to Pearl Harbor. So meanwhile, that position in Washington came open, chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics. King liked McCain. McCain was not Nimitz's favorite. McCain then became somewhat superfluous here. He went back to Washington to work under King as chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics. So he returned to Washington, and he knew about Washington. He knew how Washington worked, so that was very well. And Towers then moved to work under Nimitz at Pearl Harbor, responsible for all of the aircraft operations in the entire Pacific. So he was chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics. This was from October 42 to August of 1943. He had broad administrative responsibilities. The Bureau of Aeronautics was involved in all kinds of things relating to planning, relating to personnel, relating to procurement. Virtually everything that was going on as far as naval aviation was concerned came out of that bureau. For example, when McCain was there, they became involved in drone aircraft. They became involved with what were known as assault drones, early guided missiles. And McCain was very supportive of those operations. He had lots of personnel problems. Where do you get people to come to Washington? Washington is jammed with people. You can't get enough personnel just to work there in the bureau. He reached out to women. More than 100 wives came to work in the Bureau of Aeronautics while he was there. More than 200 women were working in the Bureau at that point. 2,000 civilians were in the Bureau at that point. So you get an idea how much that expanded. And what you see here is the what was known as Maine Navy on Constitution Avenue, a temporary building from World War I that was used throughout World War II and after. Another change took place in August of 1943, and that was the creation within the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations of the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Air. King wanted to have as much authority over operations, especially aviation and aeronautics operations, as he could, centralizing them within his Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. That meant that some of the authority that was vested in the Bureau of Aeronautics was going to have to transfer to the Chief of Naval Operations and his office. And McCain was the person on the scene, and McCain was responsible for this transition of bringing more operations from the Chiefs of the Bureau of Aeronautics to this new office of the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Air. And he served as Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Air between August 1943 and August 1944. He was there for a year. Again, more Washington duty. One of the important things that he did as Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Air was to handle aircraft procurement. And the big problem they had, and this sounds paradoxical, the big problem they had was that there were too many airplanes. The industry was producing more airplanes than they really needed in the Pacific. It was producing more airplanes than they were losing by attrition. And the problem was that was clogging up the pipeline. And McCain was responsible, through some of his associates as well, in unclogging that and getting a system using actually IBM computers at that point to be able to balance the attrition rate of what was going on in the Pacific, bringing airplanes back, scrapping airplanes if they had to, and then bringing new airplanes into the pipeline and cleaning that up as much as possible. Then he went back to the Pacific, and this is really what he wanted to do. And he went back to the Pacific largely as a result of what was known as the two-platoon system. What this meant was that the senior command of the forces in the Pacific would rotate. And especially here, Raymond Spruance, who was in many ways the hero of the Battle of Midway, along with Mark Mitcher, would carry out operations in the Pacific as part of the Fifth Fleet. Spruance was command of the Fifth Fleet, and Mark Mitcher, who by the way was a pioneer aviator who didn't have much good to say about McCain, as a Johnny-come-lately. And Mark Mitcher then would take over command of what was known as Task Force 58. Those were the fast carriers within the Fifth Fleet. Now, they would carry out a series of operations. Then they would rotate back to Pearl Harbor or rotate back to Washington. This was all developed in the spring of 1944, mostly by King. They would then be spelled by William F. Halsey as commander of the Third Fleet, with McCain as commander of Task Force 38. In other words, the ships pretty much stayed the same. The designation stayed the same. The senior command changed. While the people who were rotating out were back planning for the next series of operations, say, Spruance and Mitcher, Halsey and McCain would be actually carrying out those operations in the Pacific. It was essentially the same fleet that was taking place here, same operations that were taking place with that fleet, but the numbers changed, and as a consequence of that, the senior command changed as well. Now, it got even more complex than this. He had to share command with Mitcher. So Mitcher became commander 1st Fast Carrier Task Force in the Pacific, and McCain became commander 2nd Fast Carrier Task Force in the Pacific. So they were sharing that command, and actually it overlapped at one point. It's amazing how complex this is, and when you try to sort through this and write about it, you go, man, I'm not sure I can handle this, and I don't know whether readers are going to be able to understand what was going on here. One of the important things about McCain as well was that he recognized the talents that some of the people working under him had, and he delegated that responsibility as much as possible. And that's not easy to do. It's not easy to, as a commander, to be able to delegate that responsibility. And absolutely crucial to the operations that were carried out by Task Force 38, in particular under McCain, was his Air Operations Officer, John Thatch, or Jimmy Thatch. That confuses people too. How come it's not James Thatch? Well, it's John Jimmy Thatch, who you may have heard of, who was responsible for what was known as the Thatch Weave, which was a very complex tactical operation that allowed American naval fighters, naval aircraft, which were inferior to the Japanese Zero, to be able to do well against the Zero in those kinds of operations. Also, what was going on here was that people understood that McCain still needed more seasoning. He needed more experience in the Pacific. So he wasn't going to be just given a carrier task force command when Mitcher would rotate out. They wanted him to gain some firsthand experience as a consequence of this. So in the spring and early summer of 1944, he went out to the Pacific, worked with Raymond Spruance, with the 5th Fleet commander, and was there during the Battle of the Philippine Sea. Thatch, meanwhile, was actually on one of Mitcher's carriers, watching these operations take place firsthand. McCain was not on one of the carriers. He was on Spruance's flagship. Here was firsthand experience. Here is what he understood about carrier operations. And it was also controversial, because many people criticized Spruance for letting the Japanese fleet get away. Spruance felt they needed to stay close to the Marianas. That was where the invasion was taking place at Saipan. He felt he needed to stay close to provide cover for that. People like Mitcher, people like Thatch, and presumably McCain as well said, no, go after the Japanese fleet. Destroy the Japanese fleet. Don't let that happen again. And that lesson was really imprinted on McCain's brain when he took over Task Force Command. So eventually, McCain took over Task Force Command. He became commander of Task Group 38.1 initially. This was still learning his way. Task Group 38.1 was one of the individual carrier task groups within Task Force 38, which was still, and again, this is how it's complex here, which was still commanded by Mitcher. Mitcher decided he wanted to stay on a little bit longer in the late summer and into the fall of 1944 while these operations were taking place. So McCain got a task group command rather than a task force command at that point. And his task group was all over the place, supporting operations leading up to the landings at Leyte in the Philippines, especially operations in and around Luzon, the main island, the Palau Islands, which were east of the Philippines, and supporting that, Moratay, an invasion that he supported there with the 7th Fleet, not with the 3rd Fleet at that point. And especially here, you get an idea of how important these operations were in softening up the Philippines in preparation for the landings at Leyte. And one of the remarkable developments that took place was in early October of 1944, when there was a monumental air battle over the island of Formosa. Formosa was used by the Japanese to stage aircraft into the Philippines. And the idea was to attack those air bases in Formosa. And it was really an unbelievable air battle that took place there with McCain's forces and the Japanese forces over Formosa. Then the Battle of Leyte Gulf took place following the landings at Leyte. The Battle of Leyte Gulf was over a number of days in October 24th, the 25th, actually going into 26th as well. Again, he was in command of this task group. He had been rotated out with the task group temporarily to reprovision and rearm at an advanced base at Ulithi. While he was gone, the Battle of Leyte Gulf began. All the time here, he was monitoring communications. And one of the big problems with the Battle of Leyte Gulf was communications. And he understood the problems that 7th Fleet was having, off Samar especially, as a Japanese battleship and cruiser force came down and threatened the invasion forces at Leyte. He was monitoring this all the time. And on his own initiative, he turned his task group around and headed back toward the Philippines. He had actually been ordered to do so by Halsey, of course, who was the 3rd Fleet commander. But the communications were so delayed, he didn't get that message until he'd actually turned the task group around and was already involved in launching long-range operations against the Japanese center force. And to me, that was really the highlight of his career. Here was, on his own initiative, launching these offensive operations more than 300 miles out from the Philippines against the Japanese center force. It was really a remarkable achievement on his part, and the aviators under him as well. Eventually gained command of Task Force 38. Mitcher rotated out, finally, and he gained command of Task Force 38 at the end of October of 1944. He worked very closely with Halsey. In fact, some people argue that he was simply carrying out everything that Halsey said. But you read some of the things that Thatch said, you read some of the things that other people have said about it. No, he was responsible as the officer in tactical command for all of those operations. And one of the things that he recognized, especially in the aftermath of the operations off the Philippines in Leyte, was the threat of Japanese kamikazes, or suicide aircraft. How are you going to deal with that? You can deal with large groups of aircraft coming in. Your fighter direction can deal with that. What about individual aircraft? What about aircraft coming from different directions individually and essentially going to dive into your ships and damage or destroy them as a result? So what he did was carry out various exercises in terms of fighter direction, how you're going to be able to protect the fleet from this threat, and also how you're going to be able to suppress those Japanese aircraft from carrying out these operations. And what they referred to here was what was known as the Big Blue Blanket. Try saying that fast sometimes. The idea was to blanket these Japanese airfields in Formosa and in Luzon in the Philippines so that the Japanese couldn't launch these kamikaze operations against the fleet. Essentially, it was round-the-clock air cover over those forces as much as possible, and that was a considerable innovation. And then the 3rd Fleet and Task Force 38 ran into a typhoon in December of 1944. And it was devastating. It was one of the worst defeats, if you will, some of the worst losses that the United States Navy suffered in the Pacific throughout this time. Nearly 800 officers and men were lost. I've lost track of how many aircraft were lost. Three destroyers were lost, some of them with all hands. Big carriers and small carriers were badly damaged during this. It was a disaster. And it forced Task Force 38 and McCain to cease operations off the Philippines and return to their base in Ulithi to regroup following this disaster. Here you have the Wasp, one of these Essex-class carriers that was McCain's flagship as Task Group 38 commander and the later Task Force commander. And here you can see some operations in Manila Bay, some of these operations against Japanese forces, shipping, as well as aircraft in Luzon. Here's Halsey and McCain. I like this one. He's being awarded the Navy Cross at this point by Halsey on the left. Notice which one is dressed more appropriately for these kinds of ceremonies. Halsey was fastidious, McCain was not. And especially his cap, which was kind of a Marine fatigue cap that he put various decorations on. Halsey said that's the most despicable attire I have ever seen. And here you can see some of Task Force 38, some of the aircraft carriers at their base in Ulithi. Here's McCain on his second flagship, the Hancock. And here you can see a view of one of the light carriers. This was the Langley in the typhoon of 1944. And you just get an idea of the kind of conditions, the kind of sea conditions and wind conditions that they faced. They also carried out operations in January of 1945 in the South China Sea. Halsey and McCain looked at this as being long-range strategic operations in support of the operations leading up to the invasion of Luzon. Rather than being tethered to Luzon, rather than being close to the islands in the Philippines, why not go after Japanese forces in the South China Sea, especially in China and Indochina as well? And literally here, Task Force 38 under McCain ranged throughout the South China Sea, attacking various Japanese operations there, various facilities that the Japanese had established there, and had established in support of their operations in the Philippines as well. This took place in January of 1945. Here you can see some of the aircraft attacking Japanese facilities in Hong Kong, also over Saigon in Indochina. Here you can see some TBM Avenger torpedo planes coming back to the aircraft carrier. And now real strategic operations then taking place between May and August of 1945. This was in support of Operation Olympic. Operation Olympic was the planned invasion of the southern home island of Kyushu. The idea here was to soften up the Japanese as much as possible, to deal with the kamikaze threat as much as possible, which they felt was going to be real. They also recognized here that the Army Air Forces coming out of the Marianas could only operate in the southern part of the home islands, whereas Task Force 38 could operate anywhere off the home islands, especially in the northern part of Honshu and the northern home islands as much as possible. And these operations took place on an almost routine basis. There would be 2 days on with Task Force 38 carrying out these operations, bombing not just Japanese airfields, but also bombing industrial facilities, attacking industrial facilities, attacking the rail ferries that came from the northern island of Hokkaido to Honshu, essentially cutting off coal supplies to Honshu. That's a strategic operation as well. And then, as luck would have it, Task Force 38 and Third Fleet ran into another typhoon in June of 1945. And here I say, okay, the Navy will give you one typhoon. The Navy is not going to give you two typhoons. And to have two typhoons hit Task Force 38 and Third Fleet was too much for people in Washington. Some people were ready to relieve Halsey of command entirely. Other people said, no, wait a minute, Halsey is one of the heroes of the Pacific War. We're not going to relieve him. On the other hand, you can relieve McCain. And as a consequence of that, in late June of 1945, after the inquiry, after it was determined that McCain had responsibility, he admitted he had responsibility for it as officer in tactical command, he was relieved of his command of Task Force 38. Now, the war was going to go on. Ultimately, it would take time until September, basically, before he was going to be relieved by, of all people, John Towers in command of Task Force 38. In the meantime, atomic bombs. In the meantime, the Japanese surrendered. And McCain ultimately, at the very end of the war, just before the ceremonies at Tokyo Bay of the Japanese surrender, he relinquished command of Task Force 38 to John Towers. I also want to indicate here, as far as these operations were concerned, another controversy. Halsey wanted to go after the Japanese fleet as much as possible. People like McCain were saying, no, really, we don't want, the Japanese fleet is defeated. Why are we going to waste our resources going after the Japanese fleet or the remnants of it? They were mostly overruled. McCain's Task Force 38 attacked various elements of the Japanese fleet in the home islands. Here you can see an attack on a Japanese battleship at the anchorage in Kure. All right, what's it all mean? Well, first of all, I like to think of McCain as a casualty of war. He returned to the United States. He returned home to Coronado on September 6th of 1945 after being at the Japanese surrender ceremonies and died of a massive heart attack that evening at age 61. Mitcher died just a year or so later, also worn out from this and also one of these casualties of the war. What did he do? Well, one of his accomplishments was jointness, what they refer to now in the military as jointness. He had to work with the Marines. He had to work with the New Zealanders. He had to work with the Army Air Forces in the South Pacific. And he was very good at that. He was able to work with those people in a very constructive way that other people weren't able to do. He was also there as far as multi-carrier operations were concerned. By the end of the war, you had task groups in Task Force 38 that had upwards of 6 carriers operating together in that task group. And being able to coordinate those was crucial to what McCain was involved with at that point. He also knew personnel and procurement. He knew administration, and he knew Washington. And you tend to forget about how important the war in Washington was throughout this period of time, and he was right there with it. Yes, there were controversies. He was blamed, I think, unfairly for Savo Island. He, to a great extent, was able to do much better as far as reporting and surveillance was concerned at the Eastern Solomons. And then he did poorly, there's no question about it, in the typhoons. And he took responsibility for the disasters that took place in December of 44 and June of 45. The big picture as far as McCain was concerned was that he was an innovator. He knew how important change was to the Navy. And to a certain extent, I think here, because he was a Johnny-come-lately, he was more aware of the larger technological picture than were some of the pioneer aviators, and therefore was able to be more innovative, especially as far as some of these carrier operations were concerned. The importance of the aircraft carrier in a tactical environment, in terms of sea control, and in terms of later strategic operations and power projection was crucial, and McCain was right there. Absolutely important as far as that transformation of the aircraft carrier was concerned. So my feeling is, yes, it was a mixed bag. I tried to be as fair to McCain as possible. I tried to recognize that as a human being, he had his failings. There were things that he was responsible for and took full credit for. And there were other things that he was responsible for and deserved real credit for. And I think ultimately, he's important because how many people were able to carry out these kinds of operations, these multi-carrier operations in the Pacific? Really, there are really just a handful of people who had that kind of responsibility. And that alone, I think, was enough of an appreciation for his accomplishments to deserve this kind of treatment that I gave him in this biography. So I thank you very much. I welcome your questions. If you have any, I'd appreciate those. Thank you very much.
Was there a shortage of flying boats for intelligence in the Savo operations?
Yeah. But you'll notice where those flying boat operations were. They were oriented toward where they thought the Japanese carrier force was going to come from. They were not looking for a Japanese cruiser force coming in at night. And again, you're not doing much night operations as far as flying boat operations were concerned. So he was focused on carriers and not on a cruiser force intervening at Savo Island. And I think that's a legitimate excuse. Now, one thing that is not legitimate, and I could have mentioned this in my talk, he had been told that what you need to do is to report immediately any sightings that any of your long-range flying boats had. What he did was to wait until all the flying boats came back after their reconnaissance, consolidate all those reports, and then send them out to Fletcher and send them out to other people involved with the Guadalcanal operations in particular, which meant they wouldn't get those till about midnight. And Fletcher and Turner also said, hey, wait a minute, we need to have that information immediately. We can't wait until midnight. And McCain said, well, sure, I'll do that, and he never really did. And I think part of the problem was simply the communications. He only had so much bandwidth to work with. And I think he was concerned that if you had all these reports coming in, As the reconnaissance came back, it would simply overwhelm the radio frequencies and overwhelm the communications network, and therefore hold this and make one big report, which would come in fairly late. You know, every military commander would like to have as much information, accurate information, as soon as possible. And every military commander and naval commander also has to know that you're never going to have all that information at the time you would like to have it, and you have to operate under those restrictions. I hope that helped a little bit. Yes?
With all the troop operations that had to go back, with the island hopping, and was it just Nimitz who basically would go to MacArthur, or did McCain have anything to go to MacArthur as far as troop movements and things?
Yeah, that would all have to, and that was a problem with the Battle of Leyte Gulf, that there was no direct communication between MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Forces and Nimitz's Central Pacific Forces. Basically, what MacArthur had to do was to report back to headquarters in Washington. Washington would then have to go back to somebody, say, in the Pacific, say, Nimitz's shop in Hawaii. Nimitz then would have to then communicate directly to the Pacific forces himself. So you had this very complex command relationship and communication network that had been set up, largely as a result of compromise. You know, MacArthur was a key figure here, and you didn't want to leave MacArthur out of operations in the Pacific. The Navy wanted to carry out these operations. You couldn't leave the Navy out of these operations. So that was some of the communication problems. If you look, though, at the messages that go back and forth, McCain was looking at all these messages that were coming from MacArthur, from the Southwest Pacific. MacArthur went out of his way to tell people in the Navy what he was doing. And he would sign every communication, MacArthur, right? Well, Nimitz didn't sign anything, you know, Nimitz, and McCain didn't sign anything, McCain. He just sent these messages out, and usually they were short. MacArthur's were like 5 pages long. So he wanted to make sure. So McCain knew what was going on here, but in terms of having direct coordination with what MacArthur was doing in the Southwest Pacific during the Guadalcanal campaign or the Solomons campaign, he would have to go back through channels, back to Washington, back through Nimitz, and then to him. And that was one of the big problems that persisted throughout the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and it was one of the reasons why there were problems at the Battle of Leyte Gulf. One other thing, too, that in the planning for Operation Olympic, the idea here was that all of the naval operations would be under Halsey, and all of the land operations would be under MacArthur. So they did resolve that command relationship before the prospective invasion of Kyushu. But it took until what? The summer of 1945 to resolve that.
Professor, you briefly described the difficult initial few months the U.S. Navy encountered right after the Guadalcanal invasion. And unfortunately, Admiral Crane finds himself in command in that area under, I believe, Admiral Gormley. What kind of relationship did McCain have with Gormley before Gormley is relieved of his command and, I think, what, replaced by Nimitz?
And he was replaced by Halsey.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, replaced by Halsey. Yeah, here again are some of the complexities of that command situation. Gormley didn't come out to the South Pacific until after McCain was out there. McCain was out there on his own doing things, I could have mentioned this, for about a month on his own, responsible only to Nimitz, before Gormley got out there. Now, Gormley was commander South Pacific, so nominally he was in the chain of command above McCain, but initially McCain's dealing directly with Nimitz. Then, when Gormley finally gets out there, and he doesn't get to New Caledonia, he gets to Auckland, New Zealand. And if you got an idea about the Pacific, that's some distance from New Caledonia, where McCain is carrying out his operations and is headquartered. So that's a problem, too. And McCain would have to go back and forth to New Zealand to be able to directly deal with Gormley. So Gormley was very much hands-off in all of this. Gormley was not present when the actual planning was taking place on the Saratoga for the Guadalcanal landings. So you get an idea what some of the situation was with Gormley, and he didn't get to New Caledonia until, I think, after McCain had already left. So here was some of the complexity here. McCain understood how the Navy worked. He understood how important Gormley was, and that he was responsible to Gormley, and they go back and forth all the time in terms of their communication. But I wonder in the back of his head if he understood that really, you know, Gormley might not be up to the task here. Gormley, Nimitz finally determined, and King eventually, that he was much more of a defeatist about the Solomons campaign. McCain was much more of an optimist about it. He said, look, you just get me some airplanes. I don't care whether they're Army airplanes, Navy airplanes, Marine, I don't care, New Zealand. I'll carry out these operations, and eventually Guadalcanal and the Solomons are going to be a sinkhole for the Japanese. So he was much more upbeat about this, and probably would have stayed on in that capacity had not this business in Washington going on with Towers as chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics. So even though some people were not happy with some of the things that McCain was doing, he probably would have continued on in that command. It's amazing when you get into this how complex this stuff is. And I remember writing to some people as I got early on in this project saying, man, this is complex stuff. And they would write back to me and say, yeah, you know, welcome to the group here. We all know about how complex this stuff is. I hope that helps a little bit. We have one more?
You seem to emphasize that the typhoons had a major impact on McCain being relieved of duty. What kinds of reconnaissance preparations might he have had so he could have prevented the disasters that the typhoons brought on?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Remember the state of communications. Remember, you don't have satellite images of where these typhoons are moving. In both cases, these were very tightly knit storms that were moving very fast. And it was very hard for the weather reporting at that time to be able to track them as well as they could have. They did have reconnaissance flights coming out of some of these advanced bases that did identify where some of these typhoons were. Some of these storms were two storms that broke up and then recombined, and that made it even more difficult to determine where they are. How accurate and how timely that weather reporting was going to be to the fleet was something you had to take into consideration. And to a certain extent, McCain, in his defense, said, I wasn't getting as much information as I would have liked to have had in advance of these storms. And my response to that is, well, welcome to the club. You're not going to get as much information as you can, and sometimes you're just going to have to act on your own initiative to be able to deal with these problems. So ultimately, he was responsible for it. He understood that he was responsible for it, and he was relieved of his command, ultimately. Another way it could have happened would be, don't relieve him of command. Certainly reprimand him as they did for the December typhoon. He was going to rotate out of that command anyway in terms of the two platoon system. He was going to leave anyway, and Towers was going to come in no matter what anyway. So let him go back to Washington and then maybe relieve him or carry out some ceremonies that would be more generous to what he accomplished. But instead, you know, these were the circumstances. And I keep saying, they'll give you one typhoon. The Navy will give you one typhoon. They're not going to give you two. And somebody was going to have to pay the price for it, and it was McCain.
Thank you to William Trimble for a great discussion, and thank you to the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library for sponsoring this program of Pritzker Military Presents. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
The Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at pritzkermilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the Museum and Library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.